The state of Alabama waited 5 years to try this man for murder, and then he made them wait 5 days more. For Andrea Shackelford, the manhunt is over. Now the real trouble begins. And then a Kansas mom of five, raised on the farm, but now accused of trying to kill as many college kids as she could. Her close friend is going to join me tonight to explain how she went from girl next door to mom who could be locked away for life. And then it was a terrifying attack in the dark, a zoo worker in the jaws of a tiger. The man was saved, the tiger destroyed, but now allegations he was reckless and drunk. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Banfield. It has been almost 5 years since Minnie Shackelford was found dead on the floor of her own bathroom in Decatur, Alabama. Not just dead, but murdered. And not just murdered, but viciously murdered. She was beaten to the point of being unrecognizable, but then her killer, for good measure, strangled her too. Minnie Shackelford was just 44 years old. It took police just 4 days to identify, track down, and arrest a suspect. Yes, they caught a guy. It was Andreas Shackelford, Minnie's husband. The evidence was strong, and Andreas was charged with murder and then released on a $100,000 bond. All of this happened back in March of 2017. Minnie Shackelford's loved ones had every reason to hope and believe that justice was right within their grasp. Why wouldn't they, right? Police had found him, arrested him. His trial was all set. But then that trial was postponed. Not just once, several times. Year after year, in fact. Until this week. This past Monday. 4 years and 11 months after the murder of his wife, Andreas Shackelford was marched into that courtroom to face the music. But yet again, he asked for a delay. This time, though, the judge was having no part of it. Judge said no. They would proceed with the trial right after a short recess. But Shackelford turned that short recess into a long, strange trip. He walked right out of that courtroom, and he did not come back. So instead of this being day five of a long-awaited small-town murder trial, this was night five of an all-out multi-agency manhunt. And I said was because just 3 hours ago, they caught him. Shackelford was shackled once again. Jerry Rankin is Minnie Shackelford's son. Giselle Crosby is Minnie Shackelford's daughter. And they join me from Decatur, Alabama tonight. Welcome to the both of you. I am assuming you are both incredibly relieved tonight.
Yes, we are.
Jerry, what do you know about the capture of the man who's accused of murdering your mom?
We just got a call a couple hours ago, and it was from a local news reporter saying that he was captured in Birmingham at the motel.
And
I don't know which hotel, but
did the police give you any information, Giselle? Jerry, did they tell you anything about this miraculous end to the manhunt tonight?
No, we still haven't got calls.
So it was a news reporter that called to tell you that they had they'd gotten the tip that this had happened.
Yes.
What else do you know about it? Just the fact that it was at a hotel, and how far away would that have been from the courthouse where he walked out on Monday?
2 hours away.
No, it's like an hour. Birmingham is like 45. Birmingham is like 45 minutes to an hour away from here.
Do Do you have any idea if he was with anyone? Because it was sort of odd that, listen, it didn't go unnoticed on Monday when he came into court to start that murder trial. There was an unidentified man that, as I understand it, the two of you had never seen him with before. Nobody really knew who that man was. Did he factor into the capture tonight?
We have no idea.
And still don't know who he is or was or if he had any part of this?
No, ma'am.
So, you know, it doesn't go...
I ain't never seen a guy. He was just weird. Well, go ahead.
An unusual presence. Well, it doesn't go unnoticed by our viewers that you've got both T-shirts on with your mom's picture. Can you tell me about what happened on Monday? Just take me through the process on Monday.
Well, we got there at like 9 o'clock, and the prosecutor called us to the back, all the witnesses, which was me, my brother, and our sister-in-law. And he just told us basically the rundown of everything, of, you know, how trial was going to be each day. And I informed him that a very close relative of Andreas told me that he was going to flee. And he was just like, well, he's here today. So I guess he just assumed that since he was in court that he wasn't going to leave. And we both had to leave to go get our kids. But our sister-in-law stayed during when they was calling the jury in. And she said that they did like a 10-minute recess, and he just disappeared. He never came back in the courtroom.
So for those 5 days, both of you, Jerry and Giselle, as I understand it, this wasn't just frustrating. This just wasn't maddening. This was actually terrifying for you. You feared this man, didn't you?
I mean, I ain't never been scared of him. But, I mean, I always been aware about, like, the way he move and stuff. I ain't never trusted him, like, for these few days that he, you know, have been out. You know, I've been staying up all night, you know, just watching and just, like, you know, just on it, like, you try some, blow you back out that back door. I ain't gonna play with you.
Yeah, we never really feared him. It's just, he's just so sneaky. You just never know what to expect. So we was just watching our backs.
So did your mom fear him? Did she ever indicate to you that he was violent to her or that she had physical problems with him?
She told us some things. We knew some things, but most of the time, my mom was like, we never knew that it would go that far. Like, she pretty much could handle herself.
Yes.
So it was very shocking when we found out that she actually lost, you know, to him or whatever. But it was kind of like a sneak attack thing, I believe. I believe he broke in the house while she was asleep. And then, you know, the trauma to the head, I think he hit her in the head with something. So the whole time she had no fight. Like, she was injured already. Like,
yeah.
Well, it was an incredible attack. You know, the way the attack was described, it was that this is a person who needs to be, you know, terribly punished, the person who did that, you know, to your mom. Did you know at all if Andreas Shackelford carried weapons? Is it possible he would have been armed while he's been on this odyssey and this, you know, manhunt has been after him for 5 nights?
Yes, I believe
of
he. Yes, because he had weapons. So, I mean, I don't know for sure if he had it then, but when he was with my mom, he had weapons. So, I'm pretty sure he probably had some protection on him.
What did the prosecutors tell you about all of this? Obviously, you were all left on Monday just in shock in the courtroom after, you know, assembling everybody there. The jury's there. The judge is there. You're all seated. And that guy takes off. Did the prosecutors tell you they've got your back? Don't worry. This is not going to go away. We'll catch him. And when we catch him, what's the next step? Will you have to wait again? Or are you going to try to get this right back on the books right away?
That's what I'm hoping that they do, that they just Monday start everything back up. I don't know, I ain't got word yet, but when we first went to go see the prosecutor, they said that they had evidence, you know, like they had forensics, they had officers that have retired, there's detectives that retired, there's chairmen that's working at the University of Alabama, and that remembers everything. They have photos and everything, videos, text messages of who he's been conversating with, how many times he kind of switched the story up. And, you know, they told us that they had all of this type of evidence, but...
When they told me that if they caught him that night or that morning, that trial will likely continue this week. But since they caught him so late, I'm not sure if it's going to get pushed back another 6 months or what. They told me that they don't know.
Yeah. Those trial calendars are hard. However much time they had allotted for it, a lot of that has passed with this week. So I am just hoping, you know, you guys get the justice you are entitled to. And my heart just goes out to you tonight to have to go through all of these emotions. So thank you so much for being with us tonight. I really appreciate it, guys. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot you to go through. So, and I'm glad that this, at least tonight, you have this resolution that he's been caught. So Jerry Rankin and Giselle Crosby, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank y'all.
So, you know, almost all criminal defendants are entitled to what Andreas Shackelford did after he was arrested. And by that, I mean post-bail. Defendants promise to show up for court dates, and they forfeit very expensive bonds if they do not. They also get slapped with an arrest warrant, and usually those twin incentives are enough to make sure they show up for trial. But Shackelford is not the first to show up in court as promised, only to have second thoughts. Sometimes it happens in dramatic fashion, like with this Detroit carjacker who really, really wanted out of that courtroom and fast. Didn't look like it went over so well for him, though. But wow, what a quick move. Look at that. Then there was the casual guy. Look at that. Just, you know, not even noticed. Got out of his chair, strolled out of the courtroom and right out of the courthouse, then sprinting down the street. Well, there he went. That was easy. No one even turned and batted an eye. But there was this man on trial in Arkansas for aggravated assault and felony possession of a firearm. And it turns out he was picked up the very next day. So didn't get too far, even though he did that day. Staircases can also be an opportunity, but also an obstacle for defendants hoping to be hoping to beat a hasty retreat. This man who'd already been convicted of burglary, nailed the leap and could not quite stick the landing. Whoosh, right over. Yikes. Don't know how that would have felt. Then in Utah, a probation violator escaped from a courtroom with nobody noticing, nobody even trying to stop him, really. And check out the flip that he did over the hallway. Whoa! Ouch. Onto the floor below, but that is as far as he got. That would have been a real landing. Look at that. Oh, man. About that sheriff there trying to actually catch the fall. That was something else. Here he goes, out. And then I don't know what he was thinking, you know, about the uneven bars or something over the railing. And then those guys below trying to break the fall. You know, defendants who run, they are the bread and butter of my next guest. Chuck Jordan is the president of the National Association of Fugitive Recovery Agents, otherwise known as Bounty Hunters. I'm also pleased to welcome criminal defense attorney Charlie Rickers. Charlie, I want to start with you just because we had such a big development. You know, here we were thinking we were going to cover a manhunt tonight. Little did we know we were going to cover a man captured tonight, which is great news, you know. But at the same time, I'm so curious about this process. What will Andreas Shackelford face now that he has been caught? He has been on the lam. There have got to be sort of a bucket of other charges that he's going to face. And I'm sure that there won't be a bond offered this time.
Yeah, Ashley, you're right. You know, he's going to have a bond forfeited. He will not have an opportunity to get out of jail after this fleeing attempt. And in addition to that, in Ohio, and I'm assuming Alabama is the same, he was facing a felony. He absconded while out on bond and failed to appear in court. So he will be facing a new felony charge for failing to appear in court.
So, Chuck, tell me a little bit about your business. When you hear the news that a guy just takes off from a courthouse and is on the lam, how much of the manhunt is the officials, the sheriffs, and maybe even the FBI, and how much of it comes to you guys?
Well, in the United States, it only comes to us if there's a bail bond company involved. The vast majority of people that go on the run, they do it, you know, long before the court date. You know, most of them don't show up for court and then go on the run in the middle of a proceeding or, you know, while they're waiting for something. That's more of an impulsive kind of move. So, you know, I think in this situation, the U.S. Marshals Task Force, I mean, they acted quickly. I mean, they didn't give this guy any space, any opportunity to plan. And that's why they caught him so quickly, and they didn't catch him all that far away. They caught him in Birmingham at that motel. So, I mean, had they, you know, had it gone through the whole bureaucracy, you know, and let it sit for a while, this guy would have had an opportunity to make more plans and get further away and make the situation more difficult. So, you know, hats off to the U.S. Marshals Task Force for acting so quickly and getting the job done.
Speaking of the job, just before I let you go on that note, you know, we don't have the video back yet. It's just only a couple hours old, this capture. So my assumption is there may be body cam, maybe even a really intrepid news crew caught some of this. But from your vast history of seeing these things go down, what do you think actually went down catching him at a motel?
Well, I'm sure they went in hot, you know, prepared to deal with, you know, any type of situation they might encounter. I mean, the man's, on trial for murder. They don't know if maybe he's planning on, you know, using a weapon or suicide by cop or, you know, any type of situation could occur. So I'm sure they went in there, you know, in a tactical fashion. So I imagine it was a bit of a sight to see, you know, for the other guests there at the motel.
Oh, I would imagine, right? That's pretty traumatic. Charlie, I just don't get it. I don't understand why a guy would show up for his trial if this was the intention. Is there something I'm missing about this strategy? I mean, you've seen a courtroom or two. What am I missing? Charlie,
well,
can you hear me?
I think that it was...
Wait.
I can hear you now.
There's a question for Charlie because he's the lawyer, but did you hear the question? I can repeat it. I know your IFB was giving you some gremlins.
Please, just cut back.
Yeah, here's the question. I don't understand why the guy showed up. Like, this is mystifying to me. Is there a strategy here that I'm missing? Like, you have a better shot at getting a little bit of leeway or, you know, getting a lead start? Or what do you make of that?
You know, when you're on the doorstep of trial and when you walk in the courtroom, it can be some of the scariest times of a person's life, especially someone who is facing an accusation of murder, facing life in prison. So it could have just been the fact that he saw the room, started to actually get closer to the potential consequences of going to prison for life, and couldn't get over his own anxiety. But there's certainly no strategy in walking into a courtroom and absconding. You know, good criminal defense lawyers tell clients all the time that, you know, they face anyone accused of a crime, faces an uphill battle. And if you flee at any point, early in the process or after you've already been in the courtroom, you're just making the hill that you have to climb even steeper. So a bad strategy, if it was a strategy.
Well, listen, the $100,000 bond is nothing to sneeze at. Chuck, what happens there? Because I don't think this guy has $100,000, and he's certainly not going to have a lot of working years ahead of him if he's convicted of this crime. So what happens? Is that bail bondsman just out $100,000?
Right. I mean, if it was a bail bond company that posted the bond, because, I mean, it could have been a cash or a property at this point, I don't know. But
no, it was.
If it was a bail bond company.
It was a bail bondsman.
I would imagine that they would challenge any kind of forfeiture. I mean, the fact that he's back in custody so quickly, is definitely in favor of the bail bond company getting off that bond and not actually having to pay that forfeiture. So I imagine that the bail bond company and their attorney would be, you know, filing a motion to get off that bond once he's back in custody. And I would be surprised if they ended up forfeiting it. I mean, if it was a cash bond and the defendant posted it himself, given the circumstances, I could see that where they might forfeit it. But, the bail bond company obviously, you know, did their part. And, he did end up back in custody, which was the whole idea. So I don't think that they will forfeit that bond.
So what's weird then, Charlie, maybe you can help viewers out who are thinking, well, then what's the incentive not to skip, right? Because, you know, Shackelford didn't put the money up. He's not losing the money. Why on earth would there be any incentive for someone out on bond to skip? Because it's not really going to affect them, is it? It's just going to affect the bail bondsman. It looks like the bail bondsman is going to get his money back, too.
Well, you know, in this case, even if he were convicted, and that's not a foregone conclusion, although it might be likely, I have no idea what the evidence might show, but he's going to face a new charge. So if, for example, he was up for parole after 15 or 20 years of serving in prison, this new charge, which is failure to appear in court, is going to tack on time. And a judge has discretion for how much time they will tack on to any underlying offense that he gets convicted of. So any time behind bars now is going to be increased because of this stupid decision. And in addition to that, any jury... Go ahead, Ashley. I apologize.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
You know, any juror, they're admonished. They're told by the court, you know, don't go on social media, don't watch TV. But at times we know that certain people act as people do. They look at social media, they watch the news. I'm assuming that if this is national news, this is also all over the news in Decatur, Alabama. So people are going to look at this and they're going to think, man, if this guy's innocent, why'd he flee? So it's not going to help his cause in the trial that's upcoming.
Yeah, I think he's in a world of trouble, and what lies ahead is a world of hurt. That murder was terrible. I don't know the weight of the evidence. I certainly don't know, you know, the case, the prosecutor's case, but I do know that's a consciousness of guilt when you take off like that sometimes. Chuck Jordan, Charlie Rickers, thanks a lot. Nice to meet you guys. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, Patty Hearst. Remember that? Look at that picture. Iconic. She was kidnapped on this day 48 years ago. Almost everybody knows the name, Patty Hearst, right? It's become synonymous with kidnapping and brainwashing and extremism. And while Hearst may be the most famous case of a squeaky clean American joining a group of maniacal killers, she certainly was not the last. According to the U.S. government, this mom and teacher from Kansas not only joined a group hell-bent on killing American college kids, she also became one of its leaders. How does that happen? I'm going to ask one of her close friends when she joins me next. And then somebody just dropped $11 million worth of gold in Central Park. 24-karat gold, pure, the good stuff. So what are the odds that it's still going to be there tomorrow? That story is straight ahead. Welcome back to Banfield. On this day in history, February 4th, 1974, a 19-year-old college student was in her apartment in Berkeley, California, when a group of armed men and women stormed in, beat her fiancé, and kidnapped her. That abduction made headlines right across the country and then right around the world, not only because of the shocking nature of the crime, but also because of who the crime victim was, Patty Hearst. She was the granddaughter of publisher William Randolph Hearst, and she was a member of one of the wealthiest and most powerful families in the country. And it soon became clear that was the reason she was taken. Her abductors were part of the Symbionese Liberation Army, or SLA, a fringe left-wing terrorist organization fighting the U.S. government. They'd already shot two Oakland school officials and killed one of them. After they took Hearst, they began releasing audio tapes demanding money and food in exchange for Hearst. But then 2 months later, something kind of weird happened. In April 1974, the SLA released a tape that showed Hearst claiming herself that she had joined the SLA. And actually, it looked pretty legit because just a few days later, a security camera caught this iconic image of Patty Hearst with the gun, helping the group rob a bank. The FBI launched a huge investigation, and on September 18th, 1975, they finally caught up with her. Patty Hearst was charged with bank robbery, among other crimes. And it looked like an open and shut case. But at her trial, her lawyer said that Hearst had not been a willing participant. They claimed during her captivity that she had been a victim of rape and torture and brainwashing. They also pointed to the bank security camera video, which indeed seemed to show members of the SLA training their guns on her. But despite that, Hearst was found guilty and sentenced to 7 years in prison. 2 years into that term, President Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence, and later, President Bill Clinton granted her a full pardon. The case continues to be debated even today, 4 decades later. Was Patty Hearst a willing participant in the crimes? Is it possible to brainwash someone into committing a violent crime or maybe even take up arms against your own country? And what would make an all-American girl join a terrorist organization? After the break, we're going to dig into that last question because it's happened again. According to the Justice Department, this mom and teacher from Kansas not only joined a criminally violent group, she became one of its leaders, training girls and women to blow up American malls and lay waste to an American college campus. How does that happen? One of her former friends, who knew her just before she went down that rabbit hole, joins me live next. Welcome back to Banfield. Americans waging war against their own country. It is rare, but it does happen. Take, for instance, the case of the Kansas mom of five. Raised on the farm, like the girl next door, even started teaching. But somehow along the way, Allison Fluke Ekron lost the plot. Because the United States government now says that wholesome Kansas flower was actually plotting to kill as many college kids on an American campus as a high-powered magazine could. And she wasn't working alone, allegedly. They say that she was leading a group of other women hell-bent on killing Americans. The alleged plot? To open fire on American malls and campuses, and for good measure, they say Allison, Mrs. Kansas, was training people to blow themselves up for maximum effect, maximum carnage, maximum death count. Can't get worse, right? Yes, it can. They say one of her suicide students was her very own daughter. So what happened to Allison? I'm joined by Linda Vogan, who knew Allison back then. Linda, it's just almost unfathomable that the girl we're looking at in the pictures ended up being the person we see in the mugshot and the person that we read about in the complaint. I can imagine it's even more unfathomable for you because you know her.
Yes, it's shocking. It's not shocking to see it now because, you know, myself and another very close friend of hers, we've understood this for a very long time. We thought that she was possibly dead or in hiding somewhere in Syria, possibly Libya, even possibly Turkey, just hiding out. So, you know, to find out that she's alive and well, so to speak, that's the more shocking part, I guess.
So as I understand it, Linda, she was captured in Syria. She was flown back to Virginia just last month to face charges. It's just, I mean, I'm looking at the picture and I can't even see the same person that you know, was this cute, you know, girl with the braces in Kansas. But what kind of person was she when she was, you know, your friend?
So the person she was amazing mom. She was loving. She kept her kids close. She, one time when I was at her house, we had all our kids there and she was making a homemade Chex Mix because she wanted them to have a healthy snack. You know, she was highly educated. You know, she has her master's degree. She was very focused on education, focused on educating her children. I would say she was a parent that probably, you know, kind of free spirit, you know, wasn't really caught up in rules and regulations for her kids. So yeah, she was just really sweet, quiet, but almost, I don't know, like sometimes she was so intelligent that it was hard to hold a conversation with her. She just was kind of quiet and conversation always didn't flow with her. Yeah.
Well, so it's fascinating that you say that she's, you know, got a master's, well educated, and yet wasn't, you know, so super rules oriented. She ended up rising through the ranks of the terrorist group ISIS to become a battalion commander. I mean, it just keeps, you know, the hits keep coming. Did she ever say anything anti-American? Did she ever indicate anything that would give any red flags that she was kind of headed, you know, this direction?
Not to me before she left the United States. But while in Egypt, she did start making some comments to a mutual friend of ours, and that friend became very suspicious and very worried about her, to the point of asking some other friends in our Kansas Muslim community to reach out to her and just check on her and see if she was okay.
So let me ask you this. The allegations say that she, you know, ran this terrorist training school, and yes, by 2012, or since 2012, has trained more than 100 women and girls to use assault rifles or become suicide bombers. She gave birth to her fifth child. She'd been overseas. She came back. But there are allegations that she's married many times, and each husband maybe sequentially is killed, you know, in the kind of line of work they do. Do you have any yes. idea how many kids she actually has, and do we yes. know the whereabouts of them all?
So I know for sure that she has five children. I don't know if the two last husbands she had that were jihadists and mujahideen for the Islamic State, I don't know if she birthed any children with them, but I do know that the sixth and seventh child were twins. Never seen them, never seen pictures of them. Her oldest son left Egypt at 14. He decided that he didn't want to live there anymore, and she threw him a party. She was very sad. He was leaving to go home to Kansas to live with his father, but she allowed it, and she was, you know, okay with it. And then her daughter with her first husband, who is American and not Muslim American, that daughter, I believe, is missing. She would be roughly 24, probably. She's missing. And I don't know if the family knows of her whereabouts, but her friends definitely do not know where that daughter is. And then the oldest daughter with her husband, Volkan, which, you know, his name is on the news, and he is the person in the pictures that people have been seeing. He's Turkish, and he actually didn't know much about his religion, about Islam. She's the one that became very interested in Islam and taught him more about his religion. And my ex-husband wow. actually taught him some things about his religion. So she was very much the one in charge of the relationship. She was just a tad bit older than him. She was already a mother to two when she met him at KU. And so she very much led that relationship. It was not the other way around.
So there's another piece of information that just floored me, and that was that her 15-year-old daughter may have been the one who informed on her, that this 15-year-old told CBS News that she was 6 months pregnant at 15, that the husband that she had at 15 had been killed. Do you know anything about this 15-year-old and how the informing yeah. might have happened?
So I know that her daughter, the 15-year-old, who is now 18, in 2019, I saw a news article on, I think it was ABC News, that she was on there. And she said, I think my mom's in Kansas. I've walked from Aleppo to Raqqa because they heard that the Kurds had toppled this Islamic State stronghold in Raqqa. And that she had walked there with a group of women, and she just wanted to go home, and that her husband had been killed, her father had been killed, and one of her brothers had been killed in Syria. And she was pregnant, and that's the last we heard. So we assumed that she came home to Kansas and probably went through an extensive program of, you know, deprogramming her and, giving information to the State Department. And so we believe now that she's 18, she's able to, you know, testify against her mom, the things that she knows.
Wow. That's going to be a hell of a trial. Linda Vogan, thank you so much for coming on and trying to shed some light on just what is nothing short of an absolute mystery, how someone can turn out like that. Yeah. And I'm sorry that you've lost your friend, too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Linda Vogan joining us tonight on a story we're definitely going to follow. Also coming up, a Florida tiger is shot dead at the zoo after attacking one of the workers.
Oh, my God. Is that real?
Yeah, please.
New accusations that worker wasn't such an innocent victim. We'll tell you what he was doing to the tiger next. This week has been a bit out of control. Blizzards, blackouts, and crime. Oh, my. Wrapping up the wildest things that happened this week, I turn now to my own control room. And our senior story editor, Paula Froelich, who is live and out of control, literally. So, okay, Paula, let's start with this. They say everything's bigger in Texas. That certainly holds for the weather they've been getting, considering the number of people impacted by some awful winter weather down there. That is not normal for Texas, and I know because I live there.
Let me tell you what, as just a month after drivers were stranded for overnight on a Virginia highway, this time it happened in Texas. Outside of San Antonio, Texas, 100 drivers were strapped onto the road, almost literally, in sub-zero weathers for 15 hours. This is crazy. I mean, if this weather keeps up, the entire country is going to have a survival go bag. It's bonkers.
Yes, and I'll tell you, just from living in Texas, the mention of cold rain is enough to send everybody scrambling. They're not ready for cold weather or any of this kind of snow there. All right, I'm going to move to the warmer weather. Naples, where my mom lives. She actually just lives around the corner from the Naples Zoo. And when we're at my mom's house, we can hear the lion roaring. And so I was so upset to hear about that story at the Naples Zoo where the worker was attacked in December.
Yeah, well, there's new news on this one. Let me tell you what. So you remember this in December, this poor guy, he gets his arm stuck in the cage and the tiger's biting it and the police come. They have to shoot the tiger. All this stuff. He gets rushed to the hospital. They try to save the arm. Well, there seems to be a little bit more to the story. Apparently this guy, his name is River Rosenquist, was hired by a third-party cleaning company, and he was supposed to clean the offices, the bathrooms, the administration buildings, and guess what he wasn't supposed to clean?
I am going to go with the tiger cage, perhaps.
You know, bing, bong, you get the prize, Ash, because let me tell you what, this guy not only went out of his scope of duties, he climbed over a fence to get to the fence, and then when he was rushed to the hospital, a nurse is now saying she smelled alcohol on his breath. And for all you people out there, let me just give you a sincerely hot tip. Do not go drinking and try to pet a tiger. It doesn't work out for anyone.
No, and I am super angry because if it is a case of boozing and being stupid, a tiger is dead. They had to shoot that tiger in order to release his arm. That just makes my blood boil. Oh, okay.
It does.
So this
what?
Other
there's not going to be any charges either.
What?
Yeah.
How?
No, they've decided there's not going to be any charges, and people are so outraged that they're actually trying to change the law so that if you mess with the tiger and it's your fault, maybe they can't kill the tiger.
Should be. Okay, real quickly, let's go through this next two real fast. Okay, so
you got it.
Let's go north in Florida. There's another wildlife mystery, and it's been solved in a very Florida way. What is it?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so this is crazy. All these calves were going missing from around Lake Okeechobee.
Okeechobee.
And we all know what happens in lakes in Florida. Nothing good. And it turns out there was a huge gator in there. And behold, this 13-foot, 4-inch monster beef thief. I mean, frankly, the farmer family are lucky to get out alive. That guy had been growing strong after eating all those calves. And frankly, 13, this data,
look at that. That's not a made up, like, that's not a graphic enhancement. That's really the size of the gator.
No, it's bonkers. I mean, this is what nightmares and horror movies are made of.
Oh, that's just horrendous. And I can see why a calf would be the right sized bite size. You know, okay. That's so awful. Oh, well, I'm glad they caught him, I guess. Okay, so this one has been driving me bonkers because I love it and hate it all at the same time. So the Central Park gold. There's gold in them there hills, Paula. What's going on? Look at that thing.
Yeah, you are not kidding. And frankly, I just moved from New York. And I'll tell you what, Ashley, I am just shocked that it is still there. So this right here is a 410-pound cubed block of 24-karat gold. It's the work of a German artist named Nicholas Castello and coincides with the release of a new cryptocurrency called Castello Coin. And it's valued at $11.7 million. But don't worry, it's not going to be sold. It's really kind of an ad for the crypto coin. And by the way, for anyone who wants to steal it, because for a hot, I hate to say this, I was actually thinking of going back to New York for the weekend with my handy forklift. But it has its own security.
I just don't know how good your security is going to be in Central Park. Let's continue to follow this one. Maybe on Monday we'll have another story. Thank you, Paula, for doing this out of control. I love it.
See you next week, Ash.
All right. Okay. So it's one thing to say the chunk of gold in Central Park is worth $11 million, but what about the chunk of dirt that it sits on? More specifically, the 843 acres of dirt that make up Central Park, smack dab in the middle of Manhattan. Take a guess at how much it's worth per square foot for some context. Well, if you wanted to sell Central Park, if you wanted to buy it, what would you have to pay? For context, some of the priciest real estate around the world, an apartment in Hong Kong runs $7,789 a square foot. London, that number is way up to $10,527 per square foot. But in Monaco, the numbers take the cake, $18,326 per square foot, meaning a 2,000 square foot home in Monte Carlo will cost you 36 milbo. So what's your guess if you wanted to buy the patch of dirt called Central Park? Let's just say it's a lot of green. The number's next. You want to buy Central Park? The internet says it's $39 trillion, but we did the math. It's 843 acres at 43,560 square feet per acre, multiplied by the average cost of a square foot of land in Manhattan, which is about $1,700. And the answer is $65.1 billion for Central Park. My advice to you, wait till Black Friday. Have a great weekend.